Welcome to The Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you this afternoon?
I'm good, thanks, Nicholas. And yourself?
I'm pretty good, pretty good. And we are joined by the CEO of the IRR, Dr. Franz Cronier. Franz, how are you this morning? Afternoon, rather.
I'm very well, Nicholas. Nice to be here.
Excellent. Very good to have you on. Right, so let's get into the stories of today. And the first one is in the Free State, the town of Senekal, there was some drama yesterday, which has, I think, got a lot of people thinking a lot, to put it obscurely. There was there was this terrible farm murder recently of a fairly young guy, Brandon. I can't remember his surname, but he was murdered, and the people accused of his murder were taken to court, and they were, I think, for their bail hearing, and there was a protest outside. And at first, the protest was pretty peaceful. Sorry, his name is Brendan Horner, the murder victim. And the protest was pretty peaceful outside to begin with, but partway through, a group of the protesters decided that they needed to break into the courthouse and exact their own justice on the murder accused. They went into the courthouse, and the police fired at them and drove them back out. There was then some chaos outside. The police threw stun grenades, and the protesters destroyed a police truck, or at least rolled one over. The ANC and the EFF have both condemned this attacks outside. The Minister of Justice, Ronald Lamola, said, "Beyond this obvious destruction of private public property, yesterday's actions are an inexcusable assault on the rule of law and the criminal justice system. If such attacks against the rule of law are allowed to go unchecked, our society will run the risk of descending into anarchy. It is in the interest of everyone to ensure respect for the rule of law is defended and upheld," Minister Lamola said. France, what should we make of this mess?
You know, Nick, when the ANC and its deploy you about the importance of the rule of law, you know that something else is up. We are a country of near-anarchic criminal violence, police deeply implicated in criminality. So is the bulk of the National Executive Committee of the ANC, as our research has established. And we're a country where 500,000 people have been murdered since 1994 at a rate comparable to war-related deaths in the Middle East. So I'm not convinced that the ANC's concern is order and justice. I think it's something else, that the ANC and the EFF understand that a very important psychological Rubicon was approached yesterday by many farmers in the Free State, and perhaps crossed by some of them. And I think this is one of the most significant developments in the country for a great period of time. About in August of last year, I was invited to address Free State Agriculture, an affiliate of AgriSA. Significant because it was the first time that I'd been invited to speak on an AgriSA platform ever. They had never been very keen on our advice to take a bolder line on questions of property rights and the safety of farmers. And in that address, I said to those farmers, the members of Free State Agriculture, that your biggest battle is within, with yourselves. It's not expropriation, it's not the policy, it's not the external attackers. That your problem as commercial farmers is that you have been cowed by the stigmatization and the abuse and the propaganda, that you will not stand up for yourselves And if you cannot do that, how do you think that anyone else is going to come in and help you? And I quoted to them Stephen Biko, who said, there's nothing more powerful in the hands of the oppressor than the mind of the oppressed. And I maintain, and I did the evening before Sienacal, in a note to some organized agricultural leaders, said to them that the greatest problem your members face is they've been cowed. Their minds have been, their consciousness has been captured, and they don't have the boldness to stand up for themselves. What I think happened at Sienacal is that all changed. Vast numbers of farmers descended. They drew a very firm line in the sand. And I think their example will inspire others. And the ANC, who I know had previously counted on the fact that organized agriculture will naively and meekly negotiate away the safety, futures, and property rights of commercial farmers in the country, they'd counted on that. It was given in the ANC. Now I have to reassess this. Now, this morning when I made these points in a staff meeting, Terence, who's with us, took me to task on the question of the violence. And Terence is quite right that courthouse lynchings, which would have happened had the police not, I'm led to believe, fired those shots in the courthouse, which was the right thing for the police to do, are a complete erosion of any civilized society. And likewise, the overturning of that police van and setting it alight, these are not acceptable actions. But I think we must be careful of what is going to be an attempt by politicians and the media to create a moral equivalency between those two actions and the onslaught, both psychological propaganda and physical against the country's farmers. And I think if the momentum of Sienacal is allowed to build, and I hope organized agriculture will encourage that, it marks an absolute step change in the standing, the future, the property rights, the safety and security of farmers across the country. Nick.
So, Terence, I think one concern people might raise when they hear what Francis just said is that there is the potential for this movement now to be hijacked by more sort of extreme elements. So I think, every movement's got more moderate forces and more extreme forces. Do you think that that's a legitimate concern that we should have here in light of the violence that we've seen?
Well, look, my point on lawlessness in general. So, South Africa has enough of it. You go back to the mid 1990s. You had PAGA, the gangsters in the Western Cape. And I remember speaking to an acquaintance of mine at the time who was very sympathetic to the ANC, who said, "Yeah, I can really understand that. This was." In a sense, an early challenge to the authority of the newfound democracy. One can understand the emotions. One can understand the sort of visceral reaction. I'm very ill placed to speak against that, or when any of the other acts of violence that South Africa is subjected to. My concern is that we live in a society in which respect for the law is so frayed already. One wants to be very careful about watching it frayed any further. Look, as far as hijacking, it doesn't need to be hijacked. You simply need people, hotheads operating under that sort of umbrella to breed an enormous amount of ill feeling. I go back to something Friedrich von Zelslowitz said in the mid 1980s. It was on, why does he believe violence is fundamentally bad? And he says, because violence makes things inherently unpredictable. It makes it very difficult to try and you know, agree on parameters to negotiate, agree on what's up for negotiation, which societies have to do. Certainly, you know, I think organized agriculture has often let itself be hoodwinked, but I do watch these developments with great trepidation.
I think one of the concerns as well is that once sort of violence starts, that it will give a group like the EFF the sort of rhetorical cover they need to respond with violence, and of course to turn the ante up a lot. France, as to the concerns I've raised about extremism and the, you know, potential, I'm not going to call it retaliatory violence, but that sort of thing from the EFF, do you think that's a legitimate concern?
It's already the case, Terence and Nick. We were already there. The tipping point was behind us. Those comments of not slaughtering all the whites yet, the actual and regular and gruesome, as in the case of this young chap in Polru, attacked, tortured, murdered, and hung on a fence post to be found when the sun rises in the morning. All of that is already part of the existing strategic environment. So, you know, I heard Terence this morning, I heard you now on the question of violence. It's wrong in principle, yes. What this trying to lynch someone, a courtroom lynching, it's the end of whatever remnants of civilization are left. And there's no question on that, or the burning of a police van. But as for risks that this will put farmers at risk, we're far past that point already. And I think there's the risk too here that the media, certainly the politicians already, will seek a moral equivalency between the burning of a police van and the mayhem and murder and rape and torture across South Africa's commercial farms. That shouldn't be allowed to happen. And you can condemn that at the same time as making it very clear that when these farmers convene again, which I hope they will, in numbers, they're very clear and strong on the fact within their own ranks that not because it's strategically unwise, that's a secondary consideration, but primary consideration is it's wrong to attack people and use violence to make your points. And I think they'll be very aware of that. But I listen to Terence, listen to you. I think psychologically this Rubicon's been approached. I think it's hugely significant. And I think it terrifies both the ANC and the EFF because they understand better than almost any other groups in the country, because they practice this stuff themselves. They understand how important it is that you can get your supporters out en masse to take a firm stand against the position or a policy that you think is inherently unjust. It changes the strategic environment entirely. And I think just because of Theunakal, commercial farmers, in fact, property rights broadly in the country today, have a far better prospect of far better prospects than would have been the case 48 hours ago. And I differ with some of my key colleagues on that, admittedly. But a very nice thing about the IRR is that that's not a problem inside the organization. Nicholas, back to you.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for that. We will move on now, but it's a fascinating topic that I'm sure we will return to when the next development happens. Let's go now to actually an attack on the IRR. We talked in the show yesterday about the Association for Savings and Investment, ASISA. We criticized them a bit yesterday for a statement they released, but they, while we were recording, actually released another statement which mentioned us by name. So this is the body, the umbrella body that all of the corporations that deal with investments and savings sort of use to communicate with government. ASISA in their statement said, ASISA has taken note of the most recent attempt by the South African Institute of Race Relations to once again draw ASISA members into a prescription debate. Leon Kampfer, CEO of ASISA, says that this seems to be a deliberate endeavor by the IRR to stir up panic amongst South African investors during a time when calm and rationality is needed more than ever. Kampfer points out that in recent months, various social partners of the National Economic Development and Labour Council, various members of it, government, labour, business, and the community, did not mention prescription of assets as a possible solution. They then went on to explain that proposals to amend Regulation 28 of the Pension Fund Act to include a separate category for retirement funds to invest in infrastructure assets does not equate to prescribed assets. So I'll start with you, Terence. What should we make of this attack on our position?
Well, it's always good when your position is noticed. So I think in that sense, there actually seems to be some sort of win for us. I think that the adage about no smoke without fire. To say, well, there's no mention of prescribed assets in the recently released plans. It's a little bit like people saying, well, you know, President Ramaphosa gave an assurance that expropriation without compensation won't hurt the economy. I'm sure we could extrapolate further and say that I'm sure Hugo Chavez never said I'm going to collapse the economy of Venezuela, or Robert Mugabe said I'm going to destroy Zimbabwe. You know, they know that this is a touchy and a risky issue. Contrary to what they're saying, there is ample evidence that this is on the table. I think Enoch Godingwana, I think, who said that we'll sort of look at making things mandatory if the market's not delivering, you know, on a market friendly basis. I think Franz can correct me on my exact words there. But what I'm seeing there is a business organization that doesn't want to stir the pot. I think doing very much what much of organized agriculture did, as Franz correctly said, they appeased and they try to negotiate from a position of cooperation. And I don't think that the ANC responds particularly well to that. What I'm seeing there is I can't hear you. Close my eyes, close my ears. But it's something that I think, unfortunately, we are going to be confronted with. And I think that if this line of thinking prevails, South Africa will enter it in a much weaker position than if those responsible for managing the country's savings were to take a more prudent and measured assessment of these risks.
So one of the things I'm always amused by whenever business assures the country that something that the ANC has put in their manifesto is not going to happen is that they sort of are implying that they just don't believe that the ANC's manifesto has anything to do with their platform. Franz, what's your take on this whole debacle?
I'll tell you now, I wonder if it's a challenge to them. Would a CISA declare in a statement that none of its members or affiliates, either directly or indirectly, have entertained or engaged at whatever distance in negotiations with the government or the ANC about bringing prescribed assets in some form or another into play? Would they declare that with the same confidence of their statement of yesterday? We put it as a challenge to them. Let's see what they say. The position, what's going on here? Well, they are naive. As Terence says, the government has run out of money. The deficit this year, 700 billion, against an expenditure target of 1.8 trillion, is extraordinary. The options are limited. You can spend less money as the government, but that doesn't work because that undermines your cadre deployment networks. So, and if you undermine those, you destabilize the ANC. And the political consequence could be its demise quite quickly. And the unions, in any event, wouldn't support that. So you can't spend less, but you're running out of money. The second thing you could do is you could earn more money by growing the economy quickly. But the ideological bent of both the National Executive Committee and the Cabinet is opposed to structural reform. So that's not a short to medium term prospect. And even if it was, you've got the short to medium term implications of energy supply crisis. So through the next 3 to 5 years, there's little prospect of spending less. There's little prospect of earning more. So you could borrow the money. And that started already with the IMF from an external financier. But the IMF's money, for all the fanfare, 70 billion rand, is 10% of the deficit. It's a fraction of what's needed. And the ANC is acutely aware that any dependency on an external financier would be the equivalent of surrendering policy sovereignty. The budget speech would be written from Washington or Beijing, and the ANC would in effect cease to govern South Africa further. In any event, under those circumstances, its deployment networks and things would themselves collapse. It cannot borrow the money. So what else might it do? Well, it looks around, and is there any money? Is there a stash of cash lying around anywhere? There's an enormous one in the savings, the pensions, broader investments of South Africans, both in the public and the private sectors. And what the ANC is attempting to do is to pivot its model of governance and its deployment networks away from their dependency on taxpayer funds, given the weak performance of the economy and the limited quantum of those funds, and pivot it onto the private sector and private funds, where prescribed assets will be a prominent means of doing so. The alternative, Nick, is to say, which appears to be the line of a CISA, that the ANC would rather go out of power, stop paying grants and the civil service, rather than try to get its hands on the cash piles in the hands of private investors and institutions that manage those funds around the country. It's a palpably nonsensical position for them to take. Now, this is not something that fell out of the sky a few weeks ago. It's been coming a long time, and it's been central to the drive towards expropriation without compensation, which we've long advised has as much to do, more to do perhaps with financial assets in the country than it has to do with land. As the issue gained public prominence, the public began to push back, alarmed at the idea that the savings, the funds that ordinary, decent, hardworking people, black and white, rich and poor, enslaved to put away, might be applied to what would in effect be a continuation of the patronage and state capture networks of the past decade. And the public began to push back very hard. Now, the ANC has a very keen sense of the public mood and is an extremely capable practitioner of balance of forces theory, which means that when you're under pressure on a question of policy, you stop. You can only advance your objectives, your revolutionary objectives, when you meet with no resistance. When resistance is encountered, you stop at once. You even retreat. You lull your intended target into a sense of false security, and then you advance. Now, I've seen this play out in areas from mining to agriculture to so many other things, umpteenth times over the long time that I've been doing this job. So the ANC has backed away on using the term of prescription. What might be going on now is something quite a bit more complex. That rather than compelling funds to invest in infrastructure, regulations might rather be drafted to limit the exposure of funds to offshore investments and to limit the exposure of funds to equities. By default, then you're pushed into government debt and government bonds. You achieve the same outcome. And I think that's what's happening within the ANC. Anyone who seriously doubts that, looks at the caliber of that party today and the dire political consequences of running out of money, I don't think has a proper read on the country's reality. So I think a drive will be made at applying savings funds, whatever the term. The lobby against prescription has been strong enough that the term prescription might not be used again. But in practice, a similar policy will be pursued. The attempt will be to seize those savings gradually and then increasingly. And once they're exhausted, the next step, this is a predictable pattern, is the printing of money. So we'd reiterate perhaps this advice to ASISA. Would they declare that none of their members, affiliates, directly, indirectly, have engaged at whatever distance and through whatever back channels in negotiations with the ANC and the government about prescription and how the funds that belong to their members might be applied in order to sustain the networks of patronage that have done such damage to our country over the past decade? Nick, back to you.
Yes, something we shall eagerly await ASISA's answer on. Right. Now, for the last couple of minutes, I just want to quickly get, France, your take on the U.S. elections. So it looks like at the moment that the race is tilting definitely in Joe Biden's favor. In Florida, he's up 3.5, Pennsylvania 6.2, Michigan 6.2, Wisconsin 5.6, North Carolina 1.4, Arizona 3.4. And, nationally, he's also up by 9 points in the polls. This is compared to he's ahead of where Hillary Clinton was at this stage, which is just after when the Access Hollywood tape, which is where Trump made some comments about what he liked to do to women, dropped. And unlike the 2016 race, this race has been very stable in its polling. And Biden has maintained a fairly generous lead. The New York Times website has calculated that if the polls were as wrong this year as they were in 2016, Joe Biden would win the Electoral College with 315 Electoral College votes. So in 4 minutes, France, very quickly, is Trump going to have to rely on a miracle to come back from this, or do you think it's closer than the polls give it credit for?
Look, the polls is the wrong debate, the accuracy of the polls. Because you said, I asked you this week whether we should call it. You said it. 2016, the race was a roller coaster. And at times the margin was wide, Clinton and Trump, and then it narrowed and then it widened. And Trump just, election day just kind of hit a moment when that race had narrowed. And whatever little margin of error there was in the polling came into play, and Trump squeezes it out. You know, in some states with big electoral college numbers by 10, 20, 100,000 votes. This time around, the race has been different. That lead has been constant. So even if there is an error in the polling, there must be some error in polling. It's always a margin of error. Pollers admit to that. It's always there. It's hard on the math to see Mr. Trump winning at this time, I've got to say to you, Nick. And the poll numbers aren't the problem, the accuracy of the polls. The strategic question now is, will the stableness of this race change in the last month? I don't see why. I think Trump was appalling in the first debate. I mean, not just his manner, but the content of it all. Oh, Nick, you're going to put me – yeah, you should put all your guests on the spot. Call it. This moment, I'm telling you, I think Mr. Biden, or rather Kamala Harris, in practice, is the next leader of the most powerful nation on earth.
I think I'd largely agree with you there, France. I think that there is only one data point that I've heard that's in Trump's favor, which is that apparently Republicans, because they have been so keen on doing door-to-door canvassing, have out-registered Democrats in some battleground states. But that also could just be because the Democrats registered so many people in 2018 that they don't have voters to register anymore. Terrence, do you have anything to add in the last 30 seconds here?
Just what I've always said. I'm glad I'm not an American. I think it's a rather distressing situation.
And who do you think is going to win? If I had to force you to make a call.
If you had to force me to make a call, I'd probably flip a coin, but I would say that indications seem to be that the Biden-Harris team are likely to be the next occupants of the White House. But weird stuff happens in this world.
No, I definitely agree with that. This has been a interesting year, to say the least, and I'm surprised we do get shocked by something, although it's probably not going to be Trump winning. Anyway, with that, we're going to have to call it to a close. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the Institute of Race Relations, please become a friend of the Institute. Go to our website, irr.org.za, click the Join Us button and give us your details so we can sign you up as a friend of the Institute, giving a small monthly donation, just under around sort of 100 Rand, a little bit less, to keep funding the research, the analysis, and the alternative voice we provide. Also, please rate us and subscribe to us on podcast apps, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. And also, we want to thank our friends for their support in allowing us to keep doing what we're doing. Thank you very much, everyone, and have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.